Welcome to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, we're getting out of that sort of terrible season, and we're headed towards something good, because what's happening?
The sun is out. No, because asparagus is around the corner, and we're all very excited about it, and we're ready for spring.
I should be
and
doing a reading.
The crocuses are coming up.
Reading one of your asparagus poems.
To everyone
out
there. How I love
there.
Asparagus.
Exactly.
Asparagus, I love you.
How it's bursting through the soil.
How many ways do I love you?
Bursting through the soil.
Yeah. Okay.
Reaching for the sun.
It is, and then some of it gets covered with dirt, so it doesn't turn green.
All right. You want to get into the technical discussion of asparagus?
Sure.
Is that going to be the most exciting thing?
I think it would be extremely exciting because, really, asparagus is very good for you, and also, we have a wonderful spot here, the Eastern Shore, and you want salinated soil for the growth of asparagus, and so it's a perfect environment. So we get amazing asparagus here in Maryland.
Yeah, we definitely. It was a funny thing that kind of landed us in realizing that asparagus on the Eastern Shore was so terrific. We've gotten it from other places around the state and other states as well, but never the quality of.
Yeah, we have a beautiful, it really truly is a standout product. So one of the things about working with asparagus, because it does grow in sandy soil, is obviously you want to really wash it very, very well, and we don't use the stem.
One of the things that I know you do incredibly well, home cooks always don't wash things that well. Mm-hmm. And it's not because it's a matter of cleanliness, but it's a matter of getting using sort of mechanics to get things really clean. Washing asparagus versus washing greens, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You're using different techniques,
when
right?
When we wash greens, we put them in a very large sink with a lot of cold water. And if you're washing in the summertime and you find with greens that, your water is a little bit warmer, obviously, ground temperature is warmer. We put a few ice cubes even in our water when we wash our greens in the summer to make sure the water is really cold. We lift the green, we kind of gently swish them through and don't overload the amount of water that you have in the sink with the greens, and lift them up and drain them, and then clean out that sink, and that way you're not rinsing the dirty water back over the greens. So it's really the same thing with the asparagus.
But you're doing it again and again until that sink
until
is
that
clean.
Water, exactly. I do it until the water shows no more sand or dirt. Or bugs, for that matter. So, we probably wash our greens 3 to 4.
Bugs are not recommended in your salad greens.
Definitely not. And so 3 to 4 times washing the lettuce or greens. And with asparagus, we actually let it soak while we peel it. I do feel, unless it's very, very small, very, very, like a pencil small,
Let me back you up on mechanics 1 second. So with asparagus, unless it's really, really skinny, skinny stuff, like number 2 pencil size stuff, you're going to peel some of the base of that asparagus.
Mm-hmm.
And asparagus, when you get it, if it's coming all the way from out of the ground, where do you break it off? Where do you go ahead and not use part of it?
Where it naturally breaks off. So you'll see where it comes out of the ground, it's almost white. And it then goes to dark green. And that white part is absolutely not edible. That is really woody and texture and completely undesirable.
So you can feel the texture change from something woozy to something a little more tender and supple.
Right,
and that's where you,
and
go
you can
and
feel
it
in a natural snap. So if you just try to snap it near the base of the asparagus, you'll get an indication for the rest of your asparagus. So you don't have to snap it. You can actually cut it. And also my goal is, because I want it to all be uniform, I cut them all the same length. Now, you don't have to do that at home because you don't care if they're all uniform in size. And that way you won't waste any of the asparagus, which is nice when you're cooking at home.
So when you do have the pieces peeled, you're actually just peeling them and dropping them into a sink or a container of water, yeah.
We actually bring them in and put them in water immediately. And then we cut the ends off. We actually cut the very, very white part off and discard that. And then the woodiest green part we cut into and reserve for soup. So there are two uses for your asparagus, for sure, if you feel like making soup or some sort of a puree, because that's what you can do with the woody part, because you can get wonderful flavor from that dark, the green woody part, but you just don't want to eat it that way. So you've put it into a sink of cold water. You're now cutting it or snapping it, whichever way you choose to do. You're cutting off this woody part and saving it for soup, and you have these nice, clean-cut pieces of asparagus. you want to peel it very gently. You know, it's very easy with a peeler to really cut into the asparagus. You don't want to waste it. You just literally want that very outside part of the asparagus. And it also will cook, just a note, it will cook faster if it's peeled. It's very little bit of time, but it will actually cook a little bit faster if it's peeled.
So you have it soaking. You're soaking out all the sand and and all of your favorite bugs and all that sort of business that's in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And not just soaking, but maybe rolling it around a little bit to try to loosen up a little bit of that business. You change that water a couple of times also?
I would. And also, you know, you realize that the outside of the asparagus has little, almost like little, it looks like little buds. Well, that will, as it pushes up through the sandy soil, will also capture some of the dirt and sand. And so that's another reason to soak it. It's not just to clean it, but it's also to get some of that that might be embedded in those little pointy spear things that are on the sides of the asparagus itself.
So let's go through basic technique on cooking it, and maybe a hot sauce and a cold sauce, because those, while there are lots and lots of fancy sort of garnishes, I think that the things that people would love to have really nice local asparagus in season, and to have one or two easy go-to preparations. And then I'm going to hit you up for quick soup. Okay, so.
I went through Bocuse's book, Robuchon's book, a lot of the great French chefs, and it all comes down to what you just said, which is a couple of simple recipes, because in the end, the asparagus is what we all love, and it really just shines on its own. It really doesn't need much more. But when you go to cook it, you want salted water. I actually have an asparagus pot at home.
Have an asparagus pot at
what's
home.
What's nice is that it's the shape, the sieve inside of the pot is shaped deep so that it's the length of the asparagus, so you can actually literally sit them in there. You can put the root end down, the tip part up, and because they are delicate, you want to cook it delicately because the tips are so tender. So if you you don't have to tie them up, that's totally not necessary. We never do, but a lot
that
of people do.
That does seem slightly foolish, because you're going to get uneven cooking from that.
I've never understood that. I want my green vegetables to move around. So at the restaurant, we use a very large pot. We don't put anything, you know, a sieve in the center. We just use a large pot with a nice amount of salted water. Let them move freely in the pot. You cook them about 2 minutes. Depends on how big and thick they are. That's what it comes down to. If they're really little, maybe 45 seconds.
Pretty salty water, too.
Yeah, very salty water. And then you have your shocking. If you're not going to eat them right away, then you need to shock them. So you need an ice water bath on the side. You would pull them out gently, again, because you don't want to hurt the tips. And shock them in ice, and then reserve them until, so you're just blanching them if you're not eating them right away. So you want to cook them al dente, so they're firm. And actually, you always want them to be firm and crisp to the bite. That's what's desirable about asparagus. You want it to retain its vegetables. It is extremely healthy vitamins, excuse me. You want it to retain its vitamins. And you do that by cooking it quickly. And not too
cooking
long.
Cooking it probably for a minute, minute and a half, something like that.
Yeah, it just depends on
how thick it is.
Yeah.
I think my favorite preparation for just simple and to enjoy the vegetable is that Lamy-Louis style. There's the great old bistro in Paris, the Lamy-Louis style, where the asparagus is warm and the vinaigrette is cold.
Yeah, I agree.
And super fresh and loaded with chervil,
and
which is almost
aromatic.
Like a very anisey, aromatic vinaigrette. And the vinaigrette has, it's like very simple, clean white wine vinegar.
It's really pretty. It just truly enhances. So it's white wine vinegar. I believe it's corn oil. There's no way there's extra virgin or any kind of olive oil in there, because that would just blow, I think it would just blow out the flavor of the
asparagus. Because really, you can just tell it's white wine vinegar and chervil. Those are the only two dominant things.
It's so good. And they bring it to you and it's in a bowl, the vinaigrette. I mean, I don't know why they give
a
you so
a big glass
much.
Kitchen bowl, yeah. Because that's Lamy-Louis.
That restaurant.
You order chicken, they bring
so
you an entire
top.
Chicken.
Well, and you order foie gras, and they bring you like four
five slices.
Five slices
of it, yeah.
Yeah, and you just can't imagine that
they
that's
bring
supposed
you
to
toast
be one portion.
Every 10 minutes, and it's a pile of pieces of toasted baguette as high as you're sitting at the table.
We could go on and on about Lamy-Louis.
But that asparagus preparation, it's just like hot out of the pot like that, and the vinaigrette's obviously ready to go on the side.
And you just spoon it on yourself, which is nice. You know, you decide what you want on there. One of my other favorites is ate at Benoit this past year, and they had truffles.
Benoit's another Paris restaurant, right? A one-star Michelin.
Great bistro. Highly, highly suggest Benoit. Ducasse owns it now. It was in the family for a very long time that originally owned it, but he bought it, I don't know, it's probably been almost 10 years ago now. They served it with sabayon. Oh, so good. And sabayon is a little tricky to make, but if you can master it, it's amazing. And I'm sure they made it with champagne or white wine. And it's simply egg yolks and the white wine and a little bit of salt and pepper, and you whisk it over a double boiler until the egg yolks become very, very thick. And you at no point would ever want your eggs to get very hot. It is probably a 15-minute process to whip those egg yolks. And they added a little bit of whipped cream, folded whipped cream into it, and fresh chopped truffle, which you could obviously skip because we're moving right out of winter truffle season right now. But if you keep that in your head for next winter. If you're using white asparagus, that is next winter. But anyway, so beautiful sauce, sabayon. So we have the vinaigrette, the sabayon, and then one of my other favorite things to do with asparagus is beurre blanc. We add a little bit of whole grain mustard to the beurre blanc just before napping it over the top of the asparagus, and a little bit of goat's cheese. At La Tour d'Argent, I had an asparagus dish.
Super, this is exotic. You came back from Paris completely freaked out about this dish.
It was so good. First of all, I've never been very fond of candied orange peel. I mean, it's just not one of my... You love that. I've always kind of
I like bitter flavors.
Hated it. And this was beautifully done. So it was orange zest and caviar and egg yolk. And the egg yolk had been boiled and passed through a tammy and just, lightly passed over the top of the asparagus. And it was just so, and beurre blanc, it was so beautiful and elegant and just one of the best things I've ever eaten. And one of the amazing things about if you can get asparagus from France is their plants are very, very old. So we know that the famous asparagus comes from Landes in the southwestern part of France. And their asparagus is huge. And we tend to think of large asparagus in our country as being less desirable.
That's because the plants are not that old, so... It's these huge, thick things, but it's only the very end of the plant when the things are gigantic like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's literally something like an eight foot piece of asparagus at the very end is clipped off of.
And it's just so good. And they serve white and green asparagus this time of the year. I believe actually in Germany, white asparagus is very, very popular.
Well, it's also
around this time of the year.
It takes so much longer to try to get the green up out of the ground, and the weather changes faster. It's not as mild as it is in Western Europe, so. When we come back, we're going to get a little bit further into asparagus, one or two other recipes, wine with asparagus, which is usually a total disaster if you're not really thoughtful about it. And we're going to spend a few minutes on knives. We're going to bring out the knives when we come back on Formidable Fun Food and Wine. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And you can email us questions at foremanwolf@wypr.org if you have listener questions. And we have a few questions to get to in a little bit. One thing I want to kind of go back to, we were talking about asparagus, which maybe you're not super excited about. I know some people have childhood issues. I know many people get over that, though, which is really great.
Mm-hmm.
One thing it's because of the bitter flavors. And one of the things about that dish that you're talking about from Tour d'Argent that's so great, and one of the things is I love bitter flavors, especially loving Italian food. It's one of those things, it's a balancing point in that cooking. And that dish, you have the strong vegetable flavor, you have the fat and the richness in the dish, but you also have the bitter orange peel and the aromatics of that, and you have the salty caviar. And it's all of those different points on the palate at the same time. That's why that dish is so special.
Pretty special,
because everything's there's a tension from contrast in all those different directions at one time. It's kind of the same thing that you do in balancing a wine with asparagus. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But any other favorite asparagus recipes you want to get into? You were talking about using the stems or some of the ends for
soup.
Mm-hmm. Some of the parts that maybe are not quite as desirable for a main plate asparagus dish, but...
Anytime you're making a green soup, you want to make your soup base, as we'll call it, first. So you would want to sauté, and you really don't need much because you really want to celebrate the asparagus flavor.
When you say you don't need much, you don't need much quantity for the base of the soup?
No, I don't. You don't need much. You don't need very many ingredients going into it. We're not going to put a bunch of spices in here. We're not going to put bacon in here like I do in a lot of my soups. I mean, this is a very clean, natural, you know.
Wait, no bacon?
No bacon. Not this time. And no chicken stock. This should be vegetarian, really.
Okay.
All right. So we saute onions and shallots and butter. So small dice of both. And you don't need that much. I mean, let's say we're making soup for four people. And you're using four bunches of asparagus. And I would do probably half an onion and two shallots. Saute it gently in the butter. Do not allow it to color at all. So you're just letting it become translucent and sweet. And then add cream. I would add probably for four people, I would add a quart and a half quart of cream to the pot and salt and a little bit of pepper. And just let that soup base, as I call it, just let that work for probably 15 minutes even on low simmer, just so that the onion and the shallot have it and the seasoning has a chance to flavor the cream, and the cream actually reduces a tiny bit. So you're stirring it, staying on the bottom of the pot. You're doing it in a stainless steel pot, a heavy bottom pot, hopefully. And meanwhile, you have already all these ends that you've cleaned up and absolutely have no dirt on them at all, because you would never want that in your soup. And you want to be very careful. I'd probably wash them even one more time just before I went in, and I would make sure there was no water left on them, well drained. And once your flavor is developed, you taste your cream to make sure you like the way it tastes. That has a nice amount of salt in it. Drop in the asparagus, cook it for all of about 2 minutes, and then immediately you should have your blender set up. And please, I would always warn you to be extremely careful whenever you're pureeing something hot in a blender. Do not overload that blender.
No.
It is very close to your face.
That is super dangerous.
It is highly dangerous.
And use a great big kitchen towel or something to hold that top on.
Yeah, yes, because if you're lucky enough to have a VitaPrep, which is a great blender. It's called the Chef's Power Tool. They're very, very expensive. But if you are able to have something like that, those are nice because they have air vents in. So it's much easier to puree something that's hot. But you would just go ahead and puree that
You also maybe take it off the stove for a few minutes, let it cool off a little bit.
Sure.
The flavor is going to kind of set in with.
I just don't want you to lose the color. That's the biggest thing.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't let it sit for more than a couple of minutes. Unless you don't care about the color, but of course you do. You want it to be this beautiful green color that asparagus is naturally, and that's why you're not overcooking it, and that's why you're not going to let it sit too long. And then you're going to shock it in an ice bath. Once you puree that soup, you're going to strain it, because of course there's a lot of fiber in the asparagus, and you need to strain that out. So a very fine sieve, we call a chinois in the restaurant, or a hand sieve that you might have that has a fine mesh to it. Pass it through, and you may have to push it through. Just make sure that you're not pushing any of that fiber through. You may want to strain that soup a second time, which is what I would do. Check it for seasoning, and then if you're not eating it right away, go ahead and put it into a container and ice it down so that it cools down immediately, and then store it in your refrigerator and serve it when you're ready to.
The cool thing about that kind of a soup, because it's such a strong sort of base note of flavor, is that you can use all kinds of things as garnishes and contrast
to
show off that flavor. So a couple of favorites?
One of mine is strawberry jelly, which is so pretty and really would be fun for you to, you know, if you...
Is it something really sweet or just a little bit sweet?
No, I wouldn't put any sugar in it at all. I would puree strawberries again, and I would cook them actually. I would cook the strawberries very quickly in just a little bit of water, puree them in the blender, strain them, add a little bit of gelatin, and just lay it out in a thin pan and refrigerate it. And then you just cut into little cubes. You can chop it up, and then you can put that on top of the soup. Or the egg yolk that we were talking about before would be a beautiful garnish. Or actually one of my favorites, I love cheese with asparagus. So either the crumbled goat cheese on top or Stilton is one of my all-time favorites. I love Stilton. And a little bit of brioche or some sort of really nice white bread crouton, something fine that you just cut into a small dice or a brunoise and sauteed in a little bit of butter to brown and put that on top of the soup. That's buttery. It's wonderful. So they're what would you suggest?
Bitter things, you know me. Mm-hmm. That's I'm going to want toasted pine nuts or you know, toasted chopped hazelnuts, or a combination of, or like green almonds if you can get them, can be amazing. Or Reggiano, honestly, is about as easy. a combination of Reggiano that's just very finely, chopped or grated on the soup, and a little bit of that breadcrumb.
You can microplane it if you have a microplane.
It'd be terrific.
Microplanes are great tools because you can just I don't know. There's something about getting a grater out to me that seems traumatic.
A microplane is sort of like a bit of a wand that
you
can rub something on.
Whip that thing out and, grate and put it away. You know, wipe it off and put it away. It just seems so easy.
A box grater does seem like it's 50 years ago.
I don't know what it is about box graters. But anyway, so asparagus soup is wonderful. And, you know, that can be the focal point of your lunch.
Yeah.
Easily. Dinner, maybe first course, or if you're having a party, I love to pass, and I probably said this a million times, but I love to pass soup and espresso cups for an hors d'oeuvre. It's just such a wonderful way for people to eat something. They don't need a fork. They can just drink it while they're standing around at a cocktail party, and that would be very pretty. But you'd have to watch your wine with that. So why don't you tell us about the wine we would...
Well, I was going to say, what do you think is the worst thing you could ever drink? You've certainly tasted an awful lot of good wine. And drunk a lot of good wine.
Mm-hmm.
What is about the worst thing you can imagine with asparagus?
Chardonnay?
It can be tough. I mean, just think about the principal flavors that you get in the wines. And Chardonnay can be tough.
I say that with a question mark behind it?
A series of question marks.
It is Chardonnay, right?
You should only really be scared if you're trying to have like Cabernet or Merlot or something like that with it. Anything that has green vegetable, like a red wine that has green vegetable flavors.
That would be
flavors.
Horrifying.
Right.
Be horrifying.
Almost any red, is going to be horrendous.
Yeah.
Red wines that have like green vegetable flavors like Cabernet Sauvignon or Merlot, Cabernet Franc, those flavors would be heightened. So really, we like drinking a glass of pickled asparagus, which would be a little bit tough with asparagus.
What do you suggest?
The two places I go to, the first thing I go to is almost always Suave. And Suave is a growing zone from the Veneto that near Verona, and that area is famous for a grape Garganaga, and it's a grape that gets really nicely ripe, so you get a real big fruit expression, but the other flavor of it is kind of bitter and kind of nutty. It's almost like an almond flavor, and that ripe and sunny fruit and sort of bitter balance, that is exactly what is successful with asparagus as a flavor.
To Suave.
And there are simple bottlings, there are richer bottlings. What you don't want is a lot of oak. Think about it. Oak barrels, when they're used to flavor wines, like you mentioned Chardonnay, I immediately think of oak. There are Chardonnay that you could have with it, maybe very high-toned Chablis or Champagne that's Chardonnay only that has no oak influence.
Okay.
That's very like mineral, almost saline. That could be attractive with it. But what you don't want is something that's going to be like, think about like tropical fruit. Think about vanillin, which is what one of the big flavoring agents that comes out of oak that influences Chardonnay or other wines. Vanilla and asparagus doesn't... Yeah, that's mm-hmm. It's really hard to imagine that being successful.
Right. What about Viognier?
Viognier probably also on my really short list of horrendous things.
That's what I was thinking. And it's almost what I said when I said Chardonnay, because I don't like the Viognier varietal that much anyway.
I can love it from the right place, but it is like exotic fruit and almost like oily tropical fruit.
Exactly.
And there's a certain, like, there's exactly the application for it.
I think that would be horrible with asparagus. And
this is exactly not the application for it.
Yeah, that's what came to mind first. Yes. Okay,
No question. No question. Yeah, you always do get a little bit scared when I ask you about what is the worst.
I know.
What is the worst XXX, that you've ever.
Right.
So anyway, all right. So what is the worst knife that we wanted to talk about knives a little bit today?
What is the worst knife
you've ever owned? Like the knife that you own that you're like, why did I buy this?
Okay, I've never had a knife that was the worst one that I owned. But my mother used to have a serrated knife that was this long. What she called a bread knife
that she
had for like 25 or 100 years. I don't know. And I hated that knife. Even when I was a kid and I didn't cook, I hated that knife. Everything should be handleable. Everything should feel good in your hand. It should have a good balance. It shouldn't be too, I'm a woman. I have small hands. I don't need a big knife in my hand. And I also, frankly, something that is a smooth handle, I have an Asian knife that has copper in the blade, and it is one of the most amazing knives I've ever owned, and it has become my favorite. And when I first started cooking, which would have been in 1984, first of all, there were no Asian knives available on the market. That no one ever talked about Asian knives.
It was all German knives.
It was all German. It was all Henkel, and eventually Wusthof became really, really popular. So my first set of knives when I did my apprenticeship was, a chef's knife. and it was an 8-inch. I rarely use a 10-inch chef's knife. It's the blade is too big for me. And I don't really see a whole lot of use unless I'm cutting into a very large piece of meat, and then I'm probably using a scimitar blade. So if I'm cutting a ribeye or something, I'm definitely, which is a blade that has a big curve to the edge of it and can handle a piece of meat like a large, even a ribeye with a big bone in it.
It can go through connective tissue and that kind of thing.
As well. And also, I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen a butcher handle a knife, but a butcher will handle a knife in a very different way than a cook will. And there's a reason for that, because they're doing a lot of boning out. And when you're boning out, you need a good boning knife that is, you need two. You need one that's hard and one that's flexible. And the flexible knife.
It's usually the sort of like long, narrow.
Exactly.
Sort of.
Exactly.
Looks like you can conduct the symphony with it kind
exactly.
of a knife.
Exactly.
Right?
And those knives are invaluable. But you really need to have both if you're going to really work with anything else.
If you're using a boning knife like that, the really long guys, incorrectly, you will snap that thing.
Right. Well, and the other thing,
super
that's true. And that's with all knives. You need to be respectful of the knife and what its purpose is. As with the Asian knives, I mean, each knife almost has its purpose, which is amazing. You know, this one's for peeling carrots. This one's for, you know, daikon work or, you know, whatever. So, you know, as a base set of knives, you would want a paring knife or a small bladed knife that you can do small work with. If you had any interest in learning how to tourner, a tourner knife is invaluable to help you tourner. And tourneying is one of my favorite things to do. And if any of my cooks are listening right now, they're all laughing.
Yoga for cooks.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I love to tourner.
Contemplative and physical at once.
Exactly. Yeah. It is contemplative, especially with potatoes, because tourneying a potato is so much fun.
Well, it's one of the pleasant things.
It's
to
easy.
Tourneille.
It's easy to tourneille a potato because they're easy to tourneille. They're soft. They're perfect. Your
April Fool's joke for a cook is to give them a turnip and tell them to tourneille like
well,
a potato.
Well, or a parsnip. Parsnips are very weird because parsnips tend to be woody in the center and soft on the outside, or softer on the outside. So you have a paring knife, some sort of boning knife, if not two, a chef's knife, an 8-inch, and maybe a 10-inch. And then if you are going to work with large pieces of meat, you want a scimitar blade. And then I highly suggest some sort of bread knife, some sort of serrated knife, but not one with a super long blade. Again, I think, you know, a 10-inch blade is fine, maybe 12-inch at the most.
There's like a little 5-inch serrated that I end up using that's very small all the time, that is fantastic, both as a bread. It's big enough to be a bread knife, but it's perfect for tomatoes, all different sized tomatoes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the things about working, and I always wonder about people when I go into the major stores and I start looking at knives and I think, wow, how do people handle these knives? Because you really have to be careful with them. There are a couple of things you need to think about. If you buy any of the Asian knives, a lot of their edges, except not global, but a lot of the other knives will chip in a heartbeat. That means if you don't use the proper cutting board, that means if you don't store it in a sheath, you should go ahead and spend the $5, $10, whatever it costs to buy the sheath, which are these little plastic guards for the knives. Go ahead and buy it if you don't have a proper
wood block. Oh, if you throw it in the drawer and throw something on it,
forget
it. Yeah.
Forget it. You just might as well not have ever buy those knives because they have to be stored properly. The blade has to be protected. And then you have to learn how to sharpen them. So not only do you have to have the right place to store them, but you have to learn how to sharpen them. And thanks to the internet, there are tons of different web, you know, or videos that you can watch. And I can't explain it to you. Each knife blade has a different edge. Some knives only have one edge. They don't have two edges. So it depends on the knife. You want to just look it up and find a video and then practice because it takes some experience.
Now, you never work with Chinese cleavers. A lot of people at home like them because it's not hard to understand how to use a Chinese cleaver.
I don't use them. So, you know, but there's nothing wrong with using. I mean, you know, it's a good knife. It's just, I guess I don't like the boxiness of the edge. That's what it is. I don't like the shape of the blade.
Well, it doesn't give you a variety of different cuts. That's mm-hmm. the one thing you have to, for chopping and quick work, that kind of thing, and volume work can be great depending upon its size, but it doesn't give you a variety of cuts. Well, so it really kind of depends upon how sophisticated you want to be with your knife work. I think it's hard to get, unless you're a serious expert with one of those cleavers and have a great lead edge, which is that edge further away from you, mm-hmm. it's really hard to get sophisticated work unless you're very, very practiced with it.
Yeah, they're not fine.
It is,
knives.
However, easy to make a mistake.
Yes.
And to lose an entire finger if you're using a really big
one
because of the weight
of
those knives.
Please be very careful when you do buy a brand new knife. You know, if you don't have a lot of knife skills, please, it is and a serrated knife is absolutely the worst way to cut yourself. It is the most damaging. But getting back to stones and sharpening, you may need different stones. You do need different gauge stones, and you just to quickly understand what a steel is for is simply to hone the knife. So that's to take any little burrs or little things off the edge of a knife.
It'll help retain the edge that you have, but it's not going to make it sharper.
It cleans up the blade.
The sort of last two safety tidbits. One, cutting boards. You're only talking about like hard rubber and wooden cutting boards,
absolutely.
Correct? The only really safe ones.
Absolutely.
Because your knives will actually bite into them. If you use a ceramic cutting board or a plastic cutting board
or
melamine,
yourself.
It's going to slide.
It's going to
hurt yourself.
And you're going to hurt your knives as well.
And if you don't have some kind of a damp towel or something underneath your board,
absolutely.
When you put it on the counter, your board is going to slide, and then you can hurt yourself.
Right. So you need to stabilize the board with a damp towel. Okay, I use a kitchen towel.
Now we spent the last 5 minutes on being your parents and trying to keep you from cutting your fingers off. When we come back to Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we're going to leave the asparagus conversation. We're going to stop being mom and dad, and we're going to get into listener questions. Then we have a producer segment with Lisa Godfrey from Godfrey's Farm, a fantastic farm on the Eastern Shore that we get a ton of asparagus from and have for years. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
You asked me about wine with asparagus, by the way. The other place, and I mentioned one place, Suave. I started to talk about that. The one other place I would go is northwest of Spain. That's probably my second favorite region. And you've got a couple of different appellations there. Valdeorras, the Rías Baixas, Ribeiro, which are all exotic sounding, really clean, fresh, attractive white wines that have some of the same characteristics of the Suave. Good ripeness, but almost like a little bitter balancing point. We'll put a list of a bunch of recommended wines for asparagus, and honestly, just great spring wines up on the
That's great, because it really is a hard wine pairing. Isn't it one of the hardest wine pairings, probably?
That, artichokes, egg dishes can be tough, depending upon what, because the egg is a foil for a lot of things that have strong flavors. But those are kind of like the classic tough guys.
That's nice to have a suggestion.
Strong vegetable flavors are hard to deal with for most wines. They kind of defeat, the sort of the kryptonite of the big red wines and that sort of thing. We have a few questions from listeners. One was about wine with asparagus. Thank you, Sophie and Roland Park, for that question, which we already answered. Let's see. Difference between white and green asparagus. You started to talk about that for a moment.
So the white asparagus is the same plant. It's just simply covered with dirt as it grows so that it doesn't go through photosynthesis. So it's not turning green, and that's the difference. And one of the things about white asparagus is, just to know from a cooking standpoint, is it's very brittle. And you really have to be careful when you're cutting it. So now you need that very sharp knife, or you could actually break. You can literally break white asparagus. So it can be brittle, and your cook time will probably be shorter. And you absolutely have to peel it. There's no question. There's no choice. You have to peel white asparagus. You want to clean it up very, very well as well. And it can be a little bit, it's funny, I was reading something that said white asparagus tends to be sweeter. I completely disagree with that. It tends to be more bitter. And so we put a touch of sugar in our water. So when we blanch it in water, acidulated water. So it has a little bit of lemon juice, a little bit of sugar, and a little bit of salt.
One of the coolest things I've ever noticed is that with white asparagus, if you grill it, it almost tastes nutty. There's definitely
It is inherently nutty, in flavor anyway.
Like grilling it, you want a nice light meal, grill a piece of fish that's kind of fatty, like black sea bass or a salmon or something like that, and grill the white asparagus with it, and good olive oil and fresh herbs, and you're in good shape with that.
And I'd go in the other direction and do hollandaise, and that is one of the other classic
You with a classic rich French sauce and me with olive oil? Who knew? Who figured? Mm-hmm. Let's see. One other question we have from Tina in Catonsville. What do you look for when buying asparagus?
You know, you want them to be bright green. You want it to not look withered at all. That's what happens. Yeah.
How purple are the tips?
I forget what the percentage of water content is in asparagus, but it's like 85% or 95%. Yeah. I mean, it's almost all water, so you know that it's, as with age, it's going to start to look shriveled up. So you obviously want it to look firm, crisp, great. You know, it's with a lot of things, it's common sense. And that the head is tight, just like you would with broccoli or, you know, as well.
Yeah, but it's and that purple color should be there for almost all asparagus.
And that's one of the
If that starts to fade to brown a little bit, mm-hmm. it should be kind of like a little bit pinky purple, mm-hmm. you know, or magenta purple kind of, and not brown at all.
And there is purple asparagus as well, yeah. which is, you know, I've never worked with that, so I don't know really what it tastes like, but...
It's essentially the same stuff. It doesn't have quite the strength of flavor, so it's really not quite... To me, it's not as fun as either white asparagus or green asparagus because it's not as pure in flavor.
Well, we've had wild asparagus in Italy as well, which is amazing.
That's a great thing with just very, very simple egg-based pasta, and the wild asparagus, once you have it cleaned up, you just toss it in with, if you have an egg-based pasta, with that and butter and Reggiano, let's say, you know, just spaghetti alla chitarra or something, and just let it steam in as the pasta cools out of the water.
It's really, really, it's almost like matchstick thin.
Yeah.
Very pretty.
Yeah, but super flavored. It will perfume that. You really don't want to monkey with it too much. And now we head into our producer segment. We have on the line Lisa Godfrey from Godfrey's Farm in Sudlersville, Maryland. How are you, Lisa?
I'm doing good, thanks.
Hi, Lisa. Good Hello. To talk with you.
So I think it's been a little more than probably a decade or so that we've been getting the spectacular asparagus that you guys grow. Would you tell people about your farm, maybe the history of the farm, and what you guys produce?
Well, we've been here since, 1952. Tom's father came down from New Jersey. They were a big family with lots of kids, and lots of houses were moving into Jersey, and it was kind of hard for everybody to be supported on the farm. So him and his brother headed down to Maryland, and they bought farms down here, and he started growing asparagus. He was growing for Green Giant, him and his brother both.
Wow.
So they had a lot of processing going on back then. Since then, all that stuff has moved out, but we're still doing the asparagus.
And just to be a geek about it, what are the oldest asparagus plants that you guys have?
Our oldest right now were planted, I believe, in 98, or maybe, I think it was 98. I have a picture of my old black lab laying in the trenches, and Tom's dad, who's no longer with us, standing there, and those guys talking about what they were going to do. But that was when Tom's dad kind of handed stuff over to us because he was ready to retire. Mm-hmm. But that's our oldest field now, and it's getting close to the end. It probably just has another couple years left.
What makes it time for that field to go away?
The average lifespan is about 10 years, so it's maybe up to 15. It starts to, as the plants get older, the spears start to get a little thinner and a little more sparsely spaced, and so they get to be where, you know, there's not much there, and you just kind of give up on it.
Production's not the same.
Yeah.
So what else do you guys grow?
We have a lot of sweet corn. We have peaches, strawberries, cantaloupes, tomatoes, peppers, lots of good stuff.
So what, maybe talk us through a season, when it ramps up, through the busiest time and then through harvest time.
Okay.
Give us an idea of your calendar.
Okay. We always start with April, which is April with asparagus, which is usually around the middle of April. Things are running a little late this year, so I would guess it'd be towards the end of April. And then we'll go into strawberries. We'll start in May. And then strawberries and asparagus kind of wrap up in the middle of June, and by then we've got blueberries going. And then around the 4th of July, we always hope to have sweet corn and peaches. And then the tomatoes and cantaloupes come around the middle to later July. And then that's our real busy time where we have lots of stuff going on. And everything wraps up around Labor Day.
When you plant your asparagus plants, how long does it take for you to be able to produce?
It takes 3 years. The second year, you can maybe harvest a little bit, for about a week.
Okay.
And then on the third year, we'll harvest for, maybe 3 to 4 weeks. And then after that, on the fourth year, then it's in full production and we can do it the whole season.
What happens to the plant when you first, when you cut it back that first time? Does it continue to grow back, or do you have to move on to a different field once it's cut?
Well, you cut every field you cut every day.
Mm-hmm.
You could, on hot days, you could actually probably sit there and watch it grow.
That's amazing.
So
you have to do a YouTube video of asparagus growth.
You know, that's what they should do. They have those tiny lapse videos.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you go through and you cut it every day, and it'll, if you don't get it cut that day, it might grow too tall, and then it'll start to fern, and the heads mm-hmm. will open up, and that's, you lose some of the quality that way. So we'll go in and we'll, you know, wherever we cut every day until it's time to be done with it, and then we just let it go, and it it's kind of important for it to be let go so it can go to fern and replenish itself and, you know, get all its health back. And so those summer months with the green fern is real important to it.
We have a huge loyalty to you guys and buy this sort of as much as we can from you when the season's heavy and getting going. It's because the quality of the stuff is spectacular. What is different about the soil where you guys grow on the northern part of the Eastern Shore that makes for such a great product? Because a lot of people that grow asparagus, and we've tried a lot of people's asparagus to try to use it.
Yours is absolutely amazing.
Well, that's nice. Well, we have a sandy loam, and I think I'm not much of an expert on this, but maybe the guys further south and maybe some of those guys in Jersey have a sandier soil, and ours is a little more of a sandy loam. It's not real heavy. It's kind of perfect for growing. It's kind of perfect for vegetables, really.
There's an area in France real famous in the southwest called the Landes that has a sandy, loamy, saline soil that is flavor-wise the thing that reminds me the most of what you guys grow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in France, their plants, I guess, are just so much older. Their asparagus tends to be huge. Have you ever had any of your asparagus get to be old enough where you felt like the stalks were really pretty big, but yet still good to eat and tender?
Well, ours kind of is, it works a little bit the opposite way. It goes, it starts off its first years when it's real healthy and it's prime of its life. It has nice thick spears. And then as it gets older, as it gets into its 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th year, the stalks get thinner and thinner and thinner. So we a lot of times reconsider. I know lots of people like thin stalks, but we sort of consider the thicker stalks kind of the prime, the best of the best.
If you were going to shop for asparagus in the grocery store, what would you be looking for? What would you be trying to avoid when you see it on the on the display?
I would think that you would look. It's against our family rule to shop for asparagus in the grocery store.
Of course it is.
But
if you want to give listeners a little bit of advice on what looks right and what doesn't look right.
If you look at if you turn it upside down and look at the butt end of it where it's, sitting, where it's been cut,
mm-hmm.
it'll start to get kind of, I don't know if you want to say woody, you can see like spaces in there where mm-hmm. it's kind of been, where it's dried out. And
it tells you how long ago it was cut.
Yeah, it'll have a nice tight it'll be less fibrous, I guess. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the word I'm looking for.
What's your favorite way to cook asparagus?
We bake it. We put it on a cookie sheet and cook it real hot with some olive oil and salt and pepper.
That's good and healthy.
It's great. We just the first batch that we cook every year, we all kind of stand around the oven and eat it like french
that's
fries.
That's great. That's wonderful.
But yeah, that's sort of become our way. We do it like we eat it like that pretty much every night.
Now, your little girls, do they like asparagus right away as toddlers, or did it take them a while, or do they still hate it?
Oh, they love asparagus.
Good. Yeah, that's great.
Asparagus. Tomatoes, not so much. But asparagus, they love. And, yeah, we eat asparagus soup in the summer and in the winter. And, when it, you know, anytime, sometimes in the spring when we're selling it, it gets to be a little chilly. So we'll run home and have a pot of asparagus soup for dinner.
That's really great.
When if you're cooking asparagus for little kids, is there a way you recommend to cook it for them?
Yeah, that
to try to make them happy with it.
Yeah, their favorite way is baked. It's got kind of a crunchy outside on it, and they just kind of like that. I would blend up the asparagus when they were smaller and not have the chunks in the soup.
Mm-hmm.
But we kind of like, you know, my husband and I, we like the chunks a lot. So we kind of got them back to chunks pretty quick.
That's great. Well, we thank you so much for your what you grow, because it makes, for me, it's a joy to cook with. And I can't wait to get that first bit this year.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you.
The chefs and the restaurants are always, they start, right, April Fool's Day, they start asking, when is it coming? When is it coming? When
yeah.
is it coming? And I always say that, you know, I'll check with Lisa, but somewhere around the 15th, she's going to say we have stuff coming.
Mm-hmm.
And then somewhere between the 21st and the 25th, we'll actually get product when you have enough to sell us 1,000 pounds at a shot.
Yeah, you guys are good to us. You have great drivers that are really nice, and I, you know, we really appreciate working with you all this time.
Thank you.
Always enjoy it, and the odds of me calling you later on to find out exactly what's going on, really high.
Okay.
Well, hopefully the weather will cooperate for you, Lisa.
And if folks were trying to visit you all or your farm stand or anything like that, if they're on the Eastern Shore, where would they go?
We're in Sudlersville, which is northern Queen Anne's County, and we have a website at godfreysfarm.com, and you can go there and see all the stuff that we have, and you can get on our newsletter, and I keep you updated on all the things that are going on. And we have lots of pick-your-own, so if anybody wants to bring their families and put their hats on and take some good stuff home.
That's great.
Pick your own blueberries. Don't wear white pants, right?
Yeah, right. And yeah, I guess I should be more specific. It's strawberries, blueberries, and peaches, or pick your own. So, everybody should come out and see you.
All right, Lisa. Well, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks, Lisa. Nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
So that was great to talk with Lisa from Godfrey's Farm.
I'm just excited about her stuff.
I can't wait.
It's any minute. So.
And I know one of the other ways that a lot of people like to grill, and probably would like to hear a recipe for grilled asparagus. So do you have an idea for that, Tony?
We usually will grill asparagus. It's totally a home thing. Grill asparagus, and it's a really easy thing to coat it in a little bit of canola oil, something like that. Have the grill very hot. Dredge it in black and white sesame seeds, roll it around on the grill. You know, you blanched it first and then chilled it, and roll it around on the grill just long enough to get it hot and let it char a little tiny bit on the outside, get it crisp. And then when it comes off, drizzle it with a little bit of sesame oil and a little bit of soy, and super duper fun. Honestly, it's going to sound weird for me to have with a beer.
Okay, then. Well, you don't like the asparagus wine pairings too much, so yeah, that's...
That's a tough one, yeah. But that's a pretty fun way
Well, and that's, I think you hit on the main point there, which is that you have to blanch it first. I mean, you could put it right onto the grill, but that's just not going to work too well. You need water. You need to blanch them. So it's kind of a two-step process, but that sounds good. I love sesame oil.
Well, anyway, thanks everyone for listening to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we'll see you next time.